Pierre and His Family. Chapter 1. Hark! The note, the natural music of the mountain reed. For here the patriarchal days are not a pastoral fable. Pipes in the liberal air mix with the sweet bells of the sauntered herb. In a secluded valley of the Alps, bordering on the confines of Piedmont and Dauphiny, on the margin of a little lake which reflected on its limpid bosom the mountains that surrounded it, stood some 100 years ago the beautiful village of St. Madeleine de Belleville. The approach to the village from the side of France was through a defile of the mountains, narrow and wild, along the banks of a river, so circumscribed in its course that it had worn itself a passage fearfully profound in the rock that formed its bed. The foam it threw around it, the rapidity of its current, and the thundering noise with which it deafened the traveler, not unfrequently intimidating him, and he sought to escape from its tumultuous and raging presence as from the pursuit of some furious enemy. As the road on one side wound along the edge of precipices which overhung the river, so on the other side it was bordered by masses of rocks covered on the top with earth and verdure, which, rising one above another, carried from height to height, as on so many stages or platforms, the beautiful pines of the Alps, whose dark green hues appeared strongly contrasted with the silvery whiteness of the bark and graceful branches of the birch trees, which hung their drooping foliage in a thousand forms below. Among the rocks, in the woods, and along the sides of the road were seen at every step the beautiful flowers of the gentianella and the blue bells of the campanella, sweet violets with yellow hearts, the wood anemone with its white flowers, and the dark auricula of the Alps, which scattered in rich profusion upon that mountain air the fragrance it refused to yield when transplanted to the gardens of the plain. In coming out of this pass or defile, the valley and village of St. Madeleine gradually opened to the view, and presented in sweetest contrast an aspect infinitely lovely, its lake, its meadows, its vineyards, its groves of mulberry trees, its antique cottages mostly built of wood, with high chimneys running up into the air like so many church steeples, while the mountains beyond piled one above another, the glaciers sparkling with the most dazzling whiteness, pyramids and obelisks of granite, formed by nature and covered with perpetual snow, altogether formed a scene of greater contrast, beauty, splendor, and softness than imagination can conceive, and which could not be beheld without inspiring emotions at once of terror and delight, such as might be felt, but which language is quite powerless to describe. At a little distance from the village, beyond the mulberry trees at the end of the lake, stood the cottage of Pierre de Beauvoisin, its round roof and high chimney peeping out from among the boughs of a beautiful achagener, which shaded it from the powerful beams of the sun. Above the threshold of the cottage were carved the names of two ancestors of Pierre, who, driven by persecution from their native valley in the bosom of the Pyrenees, had here taken shelter and retaining their own language and their own customs, and bestowing them upon their descendants, had been the first to establish this little domicile, and like the rest of the houses in the village, each of which bore some moral sentence or pious distich inscribed over the door, there was sculptured on the front of Pierre's little cot the salutation of the hospitable Syrian of old, "Come in, thou blessed of the Lord, wherefore standest thou without?" Pierre, though the son of one of the pastors of the valleys, was nevertheless a soldier, we should not say by profession, but by compulsion. He had been made so by one of these many and cruel acts of oppression, to which the peaceful inhabitants of these secluded regions sometimes were exposed, and from which they had neither escape nor redress. Among the other reproaches and calumnies with which the Waldenses were loaded, disloyalty and disaffection to the princes under whom they lived had often been attached to their character. One reason for this calumny arose from their repugnance to war, their distaste for the profession of arms, and their consequent refusal, so far as possible, to serve in the armies of the state. It was not always practicable, however, for their young men to elude the levies ordered by the government in the provinces, and it was on occasion of emergency when it was necessary for the village of St. Madeleine to furnish its quota, and that the lot had fallen upon Pierre, who, with an aching heart, saw himself enrolled in the army of the king, for at that time the valleys belonged to France. Old de Boivosin, his father, bore with submission this sore stroke, which at that time he considered a grievous evil. But Pierre, forgetting his own distress, comforted his father by reminding him that he had called his attention, when a boy, to the character of Cornelius, the devout centurion, that he had pointed to the Roman soldier at the cross of Christ as bearing a testimony to his divinity which priests and scribes refused to give, saying that religion belonged to no peculiar profession exclusively, but that men might glorify God in the camp and in the guardroom, as well as in the closet. And though such a field of duty would never have been chosen by him for any of his family, yet while the world continued constituted as it was, there were many things that ought to be silently submitted to from the powers that be, because by that very submission, the great power above that ordained them all was more glorified than by resistance. Pierre had accordingly been a soldier from the time of his first enrollment, which happened about 2 years after he was married. He had served in different countries, after every campaign returning for intervals of a month or two to his native valley. Blanche, the beautiful wife of Pierre, never accompanied him to the wars, but remained at home to bring up her family and to take care of the aged pastor, her father-in-law. Old Boivosin was the father of a numerous family, on whom he had no inheritance to bestow, but that of an example of preeminent piety, and an education such as few in those days, even among the highest ranks of life, could boast. By these advantages his children had happily profited, but as St. Madeleine was too poor to support more than one pastor, the sons of the old man had wandered from valley to valley, and had become teachers, merchants, or artisans in other places, one only having obtained the pastoral office, who, on the death of old de Boivosin, succeeded him in the charge of his beloved flock, being a man of the same mind and of the same heart, and taught by the same spirit as his father. From these circumstances, Pierre had, even when at home, rarely seen any of his father's family, except the old pastor himself. He had now been dead some time, and Pierre was to see another occupying his place. For the war being finally ended and a treaty of peace concluded at Naples with the different powers, and they were about gradually to withdraw their forces. But Pierre, who had risen to a rank above that of a common soldier, having been wounded in the last encounter with the enemy, was, with the others of the sick, returning before the rest of the troops, an invalid to his beloved valley. It was on a beautiful evening, succeeding a day of sultry heat, when partially recovered from his wounds, but still languid and faint, that Pierre de Beauvoisin, with others of his comrades, was put on board a polacca in the port of Naples, bound for Marseilles, for which destination they sailed at sunset. The air was calm and cool, and Pierre, coming from the heated atmosphere of a crowded hospital, felt revived and refreshed as he inhaled the softness of the zephyr, for breeze it could not be called, which came down loaded with fragrance from the groves of Posillipo and the gardens that bordered the lovely shore. He sat till a late hour upon the deck, gazing at the flaming mountain, Mount Vesuvius, a volcano, which, like a giant with a giant's torch, lighted them out of the bay. The fleecy clouds hovering in midair, the sky and the host of heaven, which appeared as if illuminated by its fires, were reflected on the bosom of the deep. And as the waters became undulatory around the prow of the polacca, she seemed to be treading out a thousand stars. During the tedious voyage, for at that time the provincials were the worst sailors in the world, Pierre beguiled, or rather improved, the time by thinking of the many mercies of God which he had received, but especially praising him for the great blessing of peace to the nations, and that he should not again be called upon to resume the avocations in which he had now been so long engaged, and for the sweet hope which he enjoyed of soon rejoining his beloved family, and of being again employed in the pastoral occupations of the valley. He also spent many an hour in reading and meditating on that precious book, which his dear and venerable father had bequeathed to him as his dying legacy, and which he valued above all things in the world. Pierre would try sometimes to prevail on the soldiers to listen to him, as he repeated to them portions of the Holy Bible, for he durst not venture to confess among the Catholics that the book in which he so often read was the book of God, lest it should have been told to the monks and friars who were accustomed to frequent the camp to confess the dying men, and thereby have been taken from him. While the soldiers and the provincials would try to beguile the tedium of the voyage by reciting to each other stories of chivalry or romance, or legends of their fabulous saints, with them trumpery miracles, Pierre would sometimes say to the soldier next to him or to his comrades as they loitered about the ship, "Come now, my friend, come now, comrades, it is my turn to speak, listen to me. I will tell you of that which is better than the legends of a thousand saints and more precious than the spoil of a taken city. Listen and you shall judge." He would then, offering up a silent prayer to God for his blessing on his own word, begin to repeat from memory, connecting fact by fact, and minutely detailing every sacred incident, without interruption to the regular narrative, the exquisitely simple relation of the nativity, life, sufferings, and death of him who through the Ancient of Days humbled himself to become a little child, and who, though the Lord of life, became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. And whether it were the beauty of holiness, or the divine tenderness, or the unpitied anguish of the man of sorrows that affected the hearts of these rude auditors, or whether it were the power of the word of God that touched their softened souls, Pierre could not tell. But many a time he saw a tear stand in the eye of the bandit by his side, who could have trod through fields of blood, unmoved and unrelenting. He also observed with wonder and joy that often the seamen at the helm, as he raised his dark eye from the binnacle to the weather vents upon his topmast, would pass his hand across his iron face to dash away the gathering teardrop from his cheek and whistle a song the while to conceal from others his emotion. It was thus, in reciting from time to time passages of holy writ to his untaught and superstitious companions, as they lay upon deck, either wrapped in their cloaks in the evening or under the awning in the heat of the day, that Pierre passed the period of his voyage. After the manner of his own people, most of whom had the greatest part of the Bible by heart, and who may be considered as the missionaries of those days, Pierre commenced, whenever an opportunity permitted him, with some passage from the Scripture, and without pretending either to explain or to exhort, would give it in all its own sacred simplicity, saying, "And it came to pass in those days," or "In the days of Herod the king," or "In the sixth month the angel Gabriel was sent from God unto a city of Galilee named Nazareth." While, with the same singleness of heart and artlessness of manner, he would introduce other parts of Scripture, beginning with a silent petition to God for a blessing and grace, then adding, "A certain rich man had two sons," or "There was a certain rich man who was clothed in purple," or "There was in a city a judge." At other times he would relate to the soldiers the battles of Joshua, of Gideon, of Jephthah, the defeat of Sisera, and the stratagem of Jael. And often was he called upon to recount again the combat of David and the giant, and to describe the armor of the companion of Gath. To the sailors, Pierre would detail the voyage of Paul, his embarkation in the ship of Adametium, his arrival at the fair havens, his perilous voyage and shipwreck, how the angel of the Lord stood by him in the night and encouraged him to proceed. Or he would enter into all the interesting circumstances of the ship and the terror of the mariners with whom the disobedient prophet sailed to Tarshish, describing the tempest, the raging of the sea, and how it ceased from its raging. It was in this manner that the pious soldier, obedient to the word of God which he venerated and to the precepts of his father whose memory was so dear to him, endeavored freely to impart that blessing to others which he had freely received of God, displaying in all he did and said the peculiar traits of character common to the interesting people to whom he belonged, and verifying in an eminent degree the charge of the enemies of the inhabitants of the valleys, that they repeated great parts of the Bible by heart. In those days, navigation was not so well understood as it is now. The sailors were accustomed, except in fine weather or in moonlight, to make their vessels lay to. Where they were able, they would cast anchor every night. This made sailing very tedious. De Boivism, still finding his wound painful and his health only partially restored, used to long to be home again, where he was sure Blanc would nurse him so well and with so much tenderness that he would soon recover. This made him look out anxiously day by day for the first peep of his native mountains, and you may judge of the delight with which, toward the close of their voyage, he beheld the Alps, covered with snow, appear to his desiring eyes, rising to a wonderful height out of the water, for as yet the plain and the land were invisible. The sight revived his flagging spirits and excited his pious gratitude, while the Swiss soldiers on board, who had hitherto during the voyage kept singing those pensive songs of the valleys, by which its natives express their passionate love for their country and their irreprehensible desire to revisit it, beheld these snowy summits with emotions little short of transport. At length the Polacca made her port, and all on board beheld with delight the waters of the Rhone, the galleys of France, the towers of Notre Dame, and in short all those objects with which, whether as citizens or travelers, they were acquainted. And as it was here that the soldiers on board had twice embarked, and as often after seasons of absence arrived on their return, it was just that spot with whose landmarks each of them would probably be most affectingly familiar. The soldiers, being obliged to proceed inland to the town, where they were to receive their official discharge before proceeding to their own homes, set out the next day at sunrise on their journey. And when all was finally settled at the depot, Pierre, accompanied by some of his comrades, who were going part of the same route with himself, commenced his journey homeward across the Alps. I shall not enter into any particular description of the places through which he passed, nor pause to expatiate on the mountains, the forests, the rocks, the torrents, which he saw on every side as he slowly traveled along. Suffice it to say that the spot on which Pierre at last parted with his companions was just where he first came in view of that particular outline of his own mountains that rose beyond his native village, with which he had been familiar from childhood, which had often, on the midnight watch or in the silent camp, risen to the eye of his mind, or in his morning dream, had come before him with exquisite illusion. Nothing could exceed the beauty of his native valley, as it opened to his view from the Pont du Boy. Before him lay St. Madeleine de Belleville, like a sleeping infant, surrounded by the everlasting mountains that seemed placed there for its protection, and which stood the unmovable guardians of its quiet and repose, their evening summits touched with the rose tints which summer's twilight leaves upon the lofty glacier's virgin snow. The air fresh and pure, the beautiful culture of the valley, the cottages that appeared at every step, a sky of sweetest light, all presented to the mind of Pierre whatever his imagination could conceive of Eden, that happy place, and he descended the steep path before him amid a waste of fragrant weeds and flowers, giving glory to him who had created all this loveliness, who humbleth himself to behold the things that are upon the earth, and who, in the tenderness of his compassions, had preserved a poor soldier in his going out, and had thus watched over him in his coming in. When Pierre at last saw his own cottage, under the leafy shade of the Chateauneuf, his heart began to beat. Ah, what thought he if anything had happened to Blanc? What if Hubert be sick, or the baby, whom I have not yet seen, be never destined to receive its father's blessing? But oh, the joy to behold them all again. Help me, added Pierre devoutly, O my God, to sustain alike this dread of evil and this strong expectation of happiness. When he arrived at the cottage door, he was more composed. He could even admire its accustomed air of peculiar neatness. He noticed that the vine upon its side had climbed nearly over the roof, and that there were two beehives now instead of one in the garden. As Pierre entered within the little enclosure of palisados that ran round his house and past the cottage window, his tall figure wrapped in its military cloak darkened the light in the lattice, at which Hubert, his son, a boy about 12 years of age, was sitting diligently reading his grandfather's Bible, which had been lent to him by his mother for an hour, for in those days Bibles were so precious that they were always kept under lock and key. Hubert did not know that his father was coming home. He did not know that he had been wounded, or that peace had been made by the king. He knew nothing, in short, of his father since he had left them about a year and a half before, but that he was in the wars, and that his mother always cried when she saw a soldier. Hubert caught but a glimpse of the tall figure that darkened as he passed the light in the window, but recognizing the dress of a cavalier, he ran out to see who it was, and in a moment he was in his father's arms. "My father, my father," was uttered by the delighted boy, while Pierre, faint and weary with his journey, could only articulate in return, "My son, my dear son." Hubert, seeing that his father looked pale and ill, brought him with haste into the cottage, placed for him a seat, took off his heavy helmet, and was about to unbuckle his saber from his side, when Pierre's repeated inquiries for Blanche made him desist, and he ran to the pastor's house at the other end of the village to fetch his mother, who was assisting her sister-in-law in some household matters. Before going out, however, Hubert went into the other apartment of the cottage, and coming back with a baby whom, though nearly a year old, its father had not yet seen, he said, "There, little Blanche will entertain you until I return," and placing her in his arms, he ran away. Pierre received the gift with all that love and gratitude which such a treasure was fitted to impart, and embracing her soft and velvet cheek, he blessed her in the name of the God of his fathers. While Hubert was going to fetch his mother, Pierre continued to hold his dear child in his lap, giving thanks, no doubt, to that gracious providence which had preserved his beloved Blanche alive, and had given to them both another source of happiness and another subject for gratitude and praise. "The God of my fathers is my God," said Pierre, "and the blessing of my fathers is come upon me." Oh, what an unspeakable mercy to have had godly parents, whose prayers continue to be answered long after they themselves are silent in the dust. But how much more precious to have an intercessor who liveth forever, yea, who ever liveth to make intercession for the transgressors. "Oh, may it be given to me to be thankful," said Pierre, "more and more thankful for my many, many mercies." And again looking on the sweet blue eyes of his smiling infant, he held it up in his arms before the Lord, saying, "Oh, may thy blessing be on this dear child, and may I be faithful to the trust thou hast committed to me. Oh, may this child be one of those little ones whose angels behold thy face in glory." While Pierre was thus sweetly engaged in the exercise of pious and devout feelings, breathing out thanksgiving and praise, he saw from the window his beloved Blanche coming with breathless haste towards the cottage, Hubert running on before to open the little wicket for her. If the delight of Pierre was great to behold a daughter whom he had never seen before, how much greater was his joy to see his own dear Blanche, and accept that she wept almost as excessively for joy to see him as she often had done for grief in his absences. No meeting ever was more happy on earth. But happiness, my children, among all conditions of men and in every situation of life, from the most splendid to the most humble, is never unmixed with some kind of alloy in this world of imperfection. When we shall be freed from the flesh, then only shall we be perfectly happy. Pierre was happy in beholding his wife and infant, and his dear Hubert, but he inquired somewhat impatiently for the rest of his family. "Where was Antoine?" he said, "and where was Gabriel? Are they on the mountains with the shepherds, or is Antoine at his lessons? Why do they not come to see their father?" When Pierre began to inquire for Antoine and Gabriel, Hubert stole out of the room, while Blanche rose and occupied herself as if in search of something which she could not find. "My dear," said Pierre again, half smiling at his own impatience and half alarmed at her silence, "why do you not answer me? Where are the children?" "My love," replied Blanche, evading a question which she trembled to answer, "it is not yet sunset. The goats and herds do not come down so soon as this." "They will be grown very much," said Pierre, fondly musing on the remembered promise of beauty and strength which was given by his lovely daughter and playful boy. "They will be grown very tall. I shall not call her my petite Gabrielle now." "No, indeed," replied his wife, suppressing a sigh under a smiling countenance. Then, after a little, she added, "Gabrielle, dear child, reaches almost to my shoulder." Pierre then conversed about his brother, whom he had not seen for a great many years, but who was now pastor of St. Madeleine, and of the adjacent cottages and hamlets as far as the valley extended. "Our pastor," said Blanche, "left us a week ago to visit the other cottages in the valley, where there has been much sickness of late, but Louise expects he will return tomorrow." "It is a long time since I saw Pascal," said Pierre. "Does he resemble my father?" "Yes, he does resemble our beloved father," replied Blanche. But is what our father would have been at 40 years of age or younger. Pascal has his countenance, but lacks the bald, though beautiful head, and the sightless eyeballs. Yet surely he has his spirit. Oh, what a heavenly spirit! The villagers love him so much, he is almost an idol among them. Some of the sounds of his voice are so like our dear father's that I sometimes think he speaks from the tomb. You will be astonished when you hear Pascal speak to the people. He makes them tremble, smile, weep, and rejoice by turns. His voice, they say, comes into the heart, and when he pauses or ceases to speak, his eye continues the sermon. Yea, they say his hand speaks. The little children love him as much as the old people. When he goes out to walk at home or rides through the valleys, villages of the valleys, the children follow him and repeat to him their hymns, or they crowd around him to receive his blessing. Hubert says he will be a pastor like his uncle and grandfather because they are so much beloved and do so much good. "Dear Hubert," continued the fond mother, "he is a sweet boy. He comes to me sometimes when he has done all the work I have for him to do in the garden or the dairy, and with his coaxing face says, 'Now, my mother, you know what I should like so much to have the loan of just for 1 hour, for half an hour, till Gabrielle comes in, and then I will help her with the goats.' And so he goes on to entreat me to lend him your father's precious Bible, my dear, which I do, as I know he will take good care of it. When he receives it, he is ready to embrace it. 'What a treasure,' he says. 'Oh, mother, if all the world had a Bible, there would be no more cruel monks and priests.' He then sits down by the lattice and gets by heart a great many verses. He is far before his cousin Albert, though he is a year older than Hubert. I dare say Hubert can now repeat more than half of the New Testament by heart, and a great many parts of the Old." This pious father was not less thankful than delighted to hear so pleasing an account of his son, who was certainly an uncommon boy. Hubert had indeed possessed uncommon advantages. He was his grandfather's boy. He had been constantly with him. And when he became blind, which he did some time before his death, Hubert used to read to him, to walk with him, and converse with him constantly, so that his knowledge was not only superior to his years, but far above that of his station in life, for the old pastor had been in a variety of certain situations in which he had studied both men and manners in his youth, for he was not then the serious man which he afterward became. "Dearest Hubert," said Pierre, "I trust he shall one day be pastor of the valley, and be beloved like his uncle, and honored to serve God in his day and generation, as so many of his fathers have done." Then after a while Pierre added, "Does he like Latin still, and can he write well?" "The pastor," said Blanche, "continues to teach him Latin, and he writes better than the young Raymond, who often sends for him to the castle and is very kind to Hubert." "What," said Pierre, "does he write better than Raymond, who will one day be a pope or cardinal, perhaps?" "The more the pity," said Blanche, "that any of that noble house should be so, especially young Raymond, for he is a sweet youth, and notwithstanding Hubert writes better than he, yet he loves his learning, and is like them that are gone, kind to the people of the valleys, and many a prayer is sent up to heaven for Godfrey de Raymond." While Pierre and his wife were thus conversing together, he related to her all that had happened to him since he left her. And she, as I have shown you, telling him about his children and his relations, they were interrupted by the sweet sound of a pastoral pipe in the village, and the tinkling of bells which announced the return of the flocks from the mountains. Pierre, impatient to embrace his dear boy and girl, whom he had not yet seen, ran out to meet them. But Blanche, wringing her hands and lifting up her meek eyes to the heavens, followed him at a distance, trying to attain courage to impart to her husband news which she knew would overwhelm him. At the little gate in front of the cottage, Pierre saw old Benoit, the mule, on which was seated his lovely Gabrielle, with her laughing face and sunny hair hanging out from under her broad-brimmed hat. When he saw her father, she clasped her hands with delight, while he, running toward, lifted her off the mule, and embracing her, said, "Where is your brother?" Then looking round among the boys and girls who at that hour of the evening came down into the village, he could see nowhere Antoine. "Where is your brother?" he again demanded. Gabrielle, replying, "Here he is," pointed to Hubert, who was seating little Blanche upon the back of an aged goat, the patriarch of the flock, whose beautiful beard almost swept the ground, and who was carefully steadying his splendid horns, lest they should hurt the baby while playing with the bell that tinkled from his neck. "Where is your brother?" "Here he is," said Gabrielle. "He is giving baby Blanche a ride on old Saint Gothard." "No, no, that is Hubert," said the father, now becoming suspicious of some evil. "Tell me at once, where is my poor Antoine?" Blanche, no longer able to conceal the fate of her husband's favorite child, covered her eyes with her hand, and leading Pierre back into the village, told him in short that Antoine was in heaven. "Antoine dead," said Boivozin, with a look of anguish that went to the heart of Blanche. "Antoine, Antoine. Oh, my child!"